was a member of his on-screen family. A little intimacy, she said, might be nice. Robin Williams is a longtime resident of San Francisco. I grew up watching him on local television. I thought he might find it funny if I greeted him by referencing one of his local bits, an odd character named Handsome Williams, whom he created right around the time of Mork and Mindy. When I approached Williams, he was slowly pacing a few feet from his trailer. The line producer, walking ahead of me, sped up to prepare Williams for my arrival. I was about to talk to an actor whose work I admired, and who had only weeks ago won an Oscar for Good Will Hunting. When I got close, he smiled and stuck out his hand. "Handsome Williams," I said, excited, smiling, as I shook his large, hairy loaf of a hand. Williams stared at me blankly. "Handsome," he said. He'd stopped shaking my hand. He had no idea what I was referring to. He was too focused on the scene he was about to shoot to remember some goofy old bit he'd done. "Handsome Williams," I said again, unhelpfully. I felt all the soft parts of my face get blood gushingly warm. Williams let go of my hand, gracefully putting the misunderstanding behind us. He began to explain to me, in a very calm voice, that the scene we were shooting today was an intensely emotional part of the film for him. My job, consequently, was to stand there and radiate sadness. He was very kind and actually pretty helpful, and after some polite chit-chat, he thanked me for being part of the film and walked off. I was shown to the mark on which I was supposed to stand for the duration of the scene. Next to me was a guy I mistakenly assumed was another extra. In fact, he was a young actor I hadn't yet heard of, though he'd already done terrific work. Philip Seymour Hoffman. I tried to make a little small talk with him, but he was also in the zone, or trying to get there, and sent back my way some palpable energy, indicating that I should just shut the fuck up already, which I did. Tom Shadyac, the director, suddenly appeared, and walked back and forth in front of us, occasionally suggesting a few micro-arrangements. Shadyac was very cool, in a rich hippie kind of way. He'd already done a few huge movies, Ace Ventura among them, but carried himself in such a manner that his authority always seemed pleasant and gentle. Eventually he zeroed in on me. "I'm going to go a little bit tighter on him," he said to someone trailing him, "and then we're going to do a little bit more with him later." Then he spoke to me directly. "Really great, Greg," he said. "Thank you." By now I knew enough not to say anything. Not even a thank you for remembering my name, which truly was above and beyond. I just nodded. After we finished shooting, I drove around instead of going home. I'd been a competent featured extra, nothing more, nothing less, but it was enough to feel like I'd done something real. I'd stood still and looked appropriately grief-hammered, and Shadyac got exactly what he'd wanted from me. A few weeks before, I'd been ready to give up. Maybe I wasn't crazy to need to do this. As if in validation of my reborn drive, a bunch of auditions came in at once, including one for Tripp Fontaine in The Virgin Suicides, the character Josh Hartnett wound up playing. My audition tape was forwarded on to a Los Angeles casting director, who told my agent she thought I had something she could use down the line. Shortly after this, a San Francisco casting director whom I'd read for a few times brought me in for another part and said, "I don't know what you're doing, but every time you come in here, you're getting better. Keep it up." But nothing happened, and nothing kept on happening, and I could only live on the supportive words of a couple of casting directors for so long. You know you're in somewhat dire personal straits when the best news of the month is that France has won the World Cup. On July 13th, 1998, 2 days before my 20th birthday, I walked into Gene Shelton's class. I was still buzzing. France had won the World Cup. Why wasn't anyone else as excited as I was about this? It turned out that someone was. my classmate Murad, a young French-speaking Tunisian guy. After class started, I heard Murad say, in a whisper, "La France a gagné." France won. I had spoken French with Murad a few times and figured he was talking to me. I winched around in my seat, but Murad wasn't speaking to me. He was addressing, or rather trying to address, another guy to his left, who was sitting alone several seats away. This guy had a rather piratical face and presence, with a sour expression and long, messy black hair. The pirate just stared at Murad. That France had won was evidently of no immediate concern to him. "Yeah, right," the pirate said finally. "La France a gagné." Then he looked back at the stage. It was such a strange reaction. His accent, at least from what I could hear, didn't quite sound French, which he obviously knew and spoke. He looked older in everything but his attitude. He sat in his seat like a slouchy teenager in detention. The more closely I studied him, the odder he appeared. He seemed half comic book character, half hair metal icon. Was this guy French? If so, why was he so indifferent about France's victory? I had no idea how significant this moment would be in my life. This was the first time I saw the man who called himself Tommy Wiseau. 3. Do you have some secrets? Audiences don't know somebody sits down and writes a picture. They think the actors make it up as they go along. Joe Gillis, Sunset Boulevard. "All I need is a pink Angora sweater and I'm good." Sandy Schclair, the room's script supervisor. On the first day of the room's production, it was my job to make sure Tommy got up and to the set on time. This would remain my job for the entirety of filming, during which Tommy was routinely 3 to 4 hours late. In my defense, Tommy's interior clock is more attuned to the circadian frequencies of a bat or a possum than a man. He typically goes to bed around 6 or 7 in the morning and gets up at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Yet he was insisting on morning shoots for the room. After quitting my job at French Connection, I parked my Lumina in Tommy's driveway. I walked through his front door, which was ajar, and called his name. No answer. There was a kettle of boiling water on his stove, whistling away. I took the nearly empty kettle off and went upstairs. Tommy's bedroom door was closed, but I heard him make a few grumbling noises, one of which sounded like 5 minutes. I went back downstairs and sat on his couch, where I found a note from him to me that said, "You will receive majority of candy, 95%, when completion of production. I'm not Santa Claus." Candy was Tommy's unusually creepy slang for money. It was typical Tommy behavior to delay revealing an agreement's fine print until after the handshake. After 20 minutes, I went back upstairs and knocked on his door. 5 minutes, Tommy said again. I realized, sitting there on his couch, that there was a pretty significant loophole in Tommy's payment plan. What if we never completed production? Tommy briefly appeared on the staircase, looking disheveled. "We take your car, okay?" "Okay," I said, "but why?" "Because these people talk if they see my car." He started heading back to his room. "We're late," I said. "When will you be ready to go?" 5 minutes, he said. Soon I was lying down on the couch. Tommy's plan was kind of ingenious when I thought about it. How better to incentivize my involvement in the film? How else to convince me to wait on his couch for an hour after he told me he'd be only 5 minutes? What was Tommy doing? Primping, getting dressed, getting undressed, reprimping, doing pull-ups, getting dressed, primping again, falling asleep. At one point, I marched up the stairs to inform Tommy that he couldn't be 2 hours late on the first day of filming his own movie. But before I could give him this blast of tough love truth, Tommy walked out of his bedroom wearing white surgical gloves stained to the wrist with black hair dye. Tommy had actually decided to re-dye his hair before heading over to the set. I went back downstairs and started watching Spy Game. Tommy had hundreds of DVDs scattered all over the floor, though I'm not sure he watched many of them. By the time Spy Game was over, Tommy was ready to go. We were 4 hours late now, and we hadn't even stopped at 7-Eleven for Tommy's customary 5 cans of Red Bull. I think this could be deemed an inauspicious beginning. The room was being filmed on the Highland Avenue lot of Burns & Sawyer, which over the last 5 decades had become a legendary provider of cameras and equipment to mainstream Hollywood film and television productions. Burns & Sawyer's owner, Bill Muir, had made the unusual decision to let Tommy use the company's parking lot and small studio space because Tommy had made the breathtakingly expensive decision to purchase rather than rent all his equipment. This was a $1 million investment that not even a large Hollywood studio would dare. Camera and filmmaking technology is always improving, and anything regarded as cutting edge will be obsolete within 12 months. Tommy's purchases included 2 Panasonic HD cameras, a 35mm film camera, a dozen extremely expensive lenses, and a moving truck full of Airflex lighting equipment. With one careless gesture, Tommy threw a century of prevailing film production wisdom into the wind. Probably the most wasteful and pointless aspect of the room's production was Tommy's decision to simultaneously shoot his movie with both a 35mm film camera and a high-definition HD camera. In 2002, an HD and 35mm film camera cost around $250,000 combined. The lenses ran from $20,000 to $40,000 apiece. And, of course, you had to hire an entirely different crew to operate this stuff. Tommy had a mount constructed that was able to accommodate both the 35mm camera and HD camera at the same time, meaning Tommy needed 2 different crews and 2 different lighting systems on set at all times. The film veterans on set had no idea why Tommy was doing this. Tommy was doing this because he wanted to be the first filmmaker to ever do so. He never stopped to ask himself why no one else had tried. I navigated my loud, coughing Lumina through the parked trucks and construction equipment toward Tommy's reserve spot, which had been ostentatiously blocked off with large orange cones. Guess who put them there? The best description I ever heard of Tommy was that he looks like one of the anonymous, Uzi-lugging goons who appeared for 2 seconds in a Jean-Claude Van Damme film before getting kicked off a catwalk. That's what Tommy looked like now, sans Uzi. This particular day, he was wearing tennis shoes, black slacks, a loose and billowy dark blue shirt, and sunglasses, his hair secured in a ponytail by his favorite purple scrunchie. As we walked from the car to the set, he was yelling in every direction, "Why are you standing around like Statue of Liberty? You do your job. You move those here. And you film operators, don't touch anything for HD. Be delicate. We need to hurry. There is no time for waste." Everyone stared back at him with expressions that said, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Tommy was ludicrously late for his own shoot, and his first leadership step was to hassle the crew. It was not a hot day, but already I was sweating. The room's crew had been provided by Burns & Sawyer, largely thanks to Bill Muir and his sales rep, Peter Anway, who realized Tommy was going to need help operating all this expensive equipment that he knew less than nothing about. Muir and Anway's ultimate motive was to keep this production afloat for at least 30 days, which was the period Tommy had to return the pricey equipment he'd bought from them. Still, Providing Tommy with the crew was an act of legitimate kindness on Muir's part. It gave Tommy access to some cinematic veterans, among them Raphael Smadja, a French-born director of photography who'd done a ton of work in reality television. These were savvy and competent professionals, which meant they were completely unprepared for dealing with someone like Tommy. Peter Anway had worked hard to convince Tommy that the production would need a script supervisor. In terms of emotional coherence and dramatic logic, Tommy's script may as well have been written in crayon. Tommy wanted to make sure that the room was legitimate in the eyes of Burns and Sawyer. So Raphael Smadja brought his old friend Sandy Sklar in to meet Tommy. Sandy had 25 years of experience in film and television, most of it in a script supervising capacity. With his untucked flowered shirt, Selleck mustache, and hefty glasses, Sandy looked about as non-LA as it was possible to look. He was friendly and funny most of the time, though his work on The Room nearly drove him mad. Years later, Sandy would claim to have directed the lion's share of The Room, which is a bit like claiming to have been the Hindenburg's principal aeronautics engineer. Sandy later told me his first thought when he met Tommy was to wonder why his Arctic skin didn't sizzle when it came into contact with direct sunlight. He figured Tommy was probably some spoiled wild child from an oil-rich Bulgarian family who'd been paid by his parents to vacate the motherland and never come back. In their meeting, while Tommy described the room to Sandy, Raphael, who had already signed on, was standing off to the side out of Tommy's line of sight, with his hands pressed prayerfully together, silently begging Sandy to come on board. To Sandy, Tommy seemed delusional, inexperienced, and rich, so why not? Sandy was the only person on set, besides me, who'd been given a complete script of The Room. He'd done considerable work on it, mostly turning its dreadful dialogue, "Promotion, promotion, that's all I hear about. Here's your coffee and English muffin and burn your mouth," into linguistic units human beings could exchange. Beyond that, Sandy couldn't do more without rewriting everything from scratch, which Tommy would not tolerate and which Sandy had no stomach for. Sandy saw the script for what it was, unintelligible, and shot to the core with a curiously unexamined homoeroticism. But a job was a job. One of the first things Tommy did after arriving on set was check in with Raphael, who was clearly puzzled as to why Tommy was so late. His wan smile was balanced atop his little silver soul patch. Raphael was standoffish, the opposite of the gregarious, talkative Sandy. He seemed to take the fact that he was working on something as low-grade as The Room personally. But he softened to me considerably when he found out I spoke French, and became more open as production wore on. Once it was established that Raphael was eager to get going, Tommy checked in with The Room's costume designer, Safua Bright, another decent and conscientious on-set presence. Tommy had given her a minuscule budget, and so she spent much of her time despairingly combing through LA thrift stores to piece together outfits. The result was a wardrobe unit consisting of a single homeless shelter rack of clothing and a few plastic laundry tubs. Safua also had to deal with Tommy's eccentric design whims. Unsurprisingly, many of The Room's costumes would turn out to be baffling at best and catastrophic at worst. Tommy's final stop was to see Amy Von Brock, The Room's makeup artist, who'd been assigned a dusty, pathetic station to the immediate right of the stage door. Amy had no place for a mirror or a table on which to set her many brushes. After seeing catering's table, monopolized by Tommy's hot water keg, she was already deeply frustrated when Tommy plunked himself down in her chair, demanding that none of his nest show. I had to translate that. In Tommy-ese, nest means scalp. though I couldn't begin to tell you why. While Tommy's nest was being covered up, he told Amy that he wanted every actor's moles to be concealed, too. Amy looked at me. I shrugged. This experience was not going to be easy on her. I hadn't seen the room's interior sets in anything resembling finished shape, so I headed over to Burns and Sawyer's small studio space to have a look. Several crew members, who as a favor to Anway, were working below their normal rates under the assumption that the film was low budget, were staring daggers into the $6,000 private bathroom Tommy had constructed for himself near the back of the stage. This bathroom had everything: separate plumbing, extra soft toilet paper, a vanity mirror, a sink. One thing it didn't have, a door. Instead, it had a little blue curtain for a partition. This was weird for so many reasons. For one, Burns and Sawyer had a clean, roomy bathroom facility 80 feet away from Tommy's little toilet ego shrine. For another, was he really going to void his bowels in the middle of the studio, separated from the people with whom he was working only by a flimsy curtain? One of the crew hissed. What is a private bathroom doing in here? This guy had enough money to build his own bathroom? Why doesn't he just use the normal bathroom like everyone else? That's fucking ridiculous. With what we're being paid, that is fucking ridiculous. I'm totally shitting in that thing every time he's not looking. The studio door opened behind us. Greg? Tommy shouted from the doorway. Greg, I need you here. We do rehearsal. Some crew members had stuck around and were staring at Tommy with openly mutinous expressions. Don't talk to Greg, Tommy said to them. Leave him alone. I talk to Greg. Tommy dragged me outside, where he spotted the man operating the 35mm camera. He proceeded to give him the secret lowdown as to how he wanted to film Don and me today. In the 10 seconds Tommy spoke to him, the camera operator's face underwent at least 5 distinct changes of expression. Puzzlement, dismay, shock, incredulousness, and finally, bleak acceptance. I hated myself for having any part in this. I knew if I did the right thing and walked away from being Mark, it also meant walking away from a life-changing amount of money. And at the time, I didn't believe enough in myself to feel I could have earned that amount another way. I felt my weaknesses were being exploited, and I was letting it happen. Maybe that's why I was dispirited. Tommy had made me realize that I had a price. I knew what Tommy was doing to Don was duplicitous and even cruel. But now I was struck afresh by how incredibly wasteful an idea this was. Tommy was wasting the cameraman's time and obviously Don's time, but also the lighting people's time and the sound guy's time and the makeup person's time and the costume designer's time, all because he didn't want to engage Don directly. It was strange. Tommy normally thrived within the black light of confrontation. The actors were all waiting around for Tommy to start doing something. It was, after all, hours past their call time. Tommy was insistent that the entire cast, even those who weren't shooting that day, be on set all day, every day of filming. He loved to spontaneously include actors in scenes they were not originally written into. If you were an actor on the room, every day was a surprise.
Everyone, Tommy said, waving his arms. Now please listen. I need crew here too.
With everyone gathered around, I looked at the actors with whom I'd grown so familiar over the last few months. Scott Holmes, who was playing Mike, and who was eventually credited as Mike Holmes because Tommy forgot his real name. Philip Haldeman, Denny, Juliette Danielle, Lisa, Carolyn Minot, Lisa's mother, Claudette, Brianna Tate, Lisa's friend, Michelle, Dan Jan Jigen, the uniquely named Chris R., and Don himself, who already looked suspicious. Everyone seemed wiped out. Months of Tommy's drama, loony rehearsals, vicious arguments, and a blowout between Tommy and the cast just days before had left us all on edge. "So," he said, "Greg is here, as you know, and I have news that we want to see him. Producers want to see Greg for future project. So he's going to do a couple scenes today on film with you guys. Producers want him on the film, okay? That's what they say," he shrugged. "So we need to organize cameras, etc., etc." The cast tried to wrap their minds around this odd announcement. "Who's he playing?" Brianna asked. Tommy answered, "He's going to be playing the Mark for a rehearsal process. The producers want to see him as the Mark." Dawn turned to Brianna. No one was aware then that they'd been secretly dating, and exchanged a pregnant look with her. Then Dawn's eyes found mine. I shrugged at him. Tommy dismissed us with the promise that rehearsals would begin in 20 minutes. I tried to go find some place inside the Burns and Sawyer studio to hide, but Dawn caught up to me. "Hey," he said, his head a tilt. I smiled at him with as much genuine, non-backstabby warmth as I could muster. Weren't you going to go out for a soap or something?" A week or so before, I'd had to take off during rehearsal to audition for The Young and the Restless, a part I didn't land. I'd only told Brianna about it, but word had obviously wended its way back to Dawn. "Yeah," I said. Dawn's eyes filled with jumpy, peaked alertness. "So did you get it?" Yeah. I still don't know why I said yes. I think Dawn's manic, newfound interest in my career was freaking me out a little. "Hey!" Now Dawn was smiling. "That's great. Congratulations." He looked back at Tommy for a moment, as though having finally made sense of the situation. "So," he said assertively, "you're auditioning for some other thing for the producers. Or does this have anything to do with the soap?" "No," I said, "it's something different." This was getting ridiculous. For all Dawn knew, I was an intern. Yet here I was, appearing to be effortlessly moving ahead in his field while he was stuck trying to get tape in the room. "What's your character's name?" Dawn asked suddenly. I hesitated. "In the soap?" "Yeah." "Tristan." "Well," Dawn said, drifting away from me now, "sounds exciting. Good luck." Brianna, too, tracked me down to extend her congratulations, a thin cover for wanting to know what the hell was really going on. Brianna had not had a good experience with Tommy to date. A week before, in what turned out to be a disastrously intemperate cast meeting in the Burns and Sawyer office, Brianna had asked why Tommy was always hours late and why, since it was so hot, did he not have water available for them to drink. Tommy erupted, yelling, "Nobody in Hollywood will give you water!" before chucking a plastic water bottle at Brianna's head. Brianna and the rest of the cast walked out and almost quit the film entirely. I didn't blame them. Brianna, an actress even if a camera wasn't pointing at her, looked like the sort of pretty blonde earth child who should have small, colorful birds floating about her head and chipmunks sitting contentedly on her shoulders. She had asked me several times why I wasn't in the room. Now she was saying, "I told you, Greg, I told you you should have been in front of the camera instead of interning." "Thanks," I said. "It's probably going to turn out to be nothing, though." "Producer," she said, turning the word into an implicit accusation. The first scene we shot for The Room was on the remarkably fake alley set that Tommy had built in the studio space. Tommy's rationale for choosing not to film in the real alley that was literally right outside Burns and Sawyer's door? "Because we do first-class production. No Mickey Mouse stuff." The alley scene's major players were Johnny, Chris R., Mark, and Denny, whom Sandy referred to as the weirdest character I've ever encountered in 25 years of filmmaking. During the making of The Room, Tommy demanded that Philip Haldeman, who was playing Denny, enter some scenes singing his lines, asked him to cry hysterically while Juliet yelled, "What kind of drugs?" and made him lingeringly eat an apple early in the film because, Tommy explained, this was very sexual symbol. Given the nature of the character Philip Haldeman was asked to play, a man-child, peeping Tom neighbor who has no purpose in the story other than to ambiguously propose a threesome and be saved from a drug dealer, he did about as well as any young actor could have. Philip was 26 at the time, older than I, Scott, Brianna, or Juliet, but Tommy still cast him as the youngest character in the film. Tommy wasn't clear in the script about Denny's age or anything else, but we all assumed Tommy wanted Denny to be between 15 and 18. Philip looked young, but not that young, which makes every scene he's in that much more uncomfortable. In an attempt to make Philip appear more youthful, Safua had fit him in a tunic-length Charlie Brown goes to prep school rugby shirt. I felt for Philip. Everyone did. Don, meanwhile, was warming up a few feet away from me. His spiky, dirty blonde hair appeared to have been newly highlighted. He was wearing slacks and an off-white Abercrombie & Fitch collared shirt, which had been generously unbuttoned. Tommy was ready to go now, too, having changed into black Nike cross trainers and dress pants. He walked past Don and said, "Don't try to be Brando today because you will hurt yourself." Dan Janjigian was playing Chris R., the room's resident drug dealer. Despite having only 90 seconds of screen time and having been cast as a complete fluke, he turned in what is commonly regarded as the single best performance in the room. Tommy had had a lot of trouble casting the part of Chris R., probably because he chose to greet most of the guys auditioning for the part by jumping them when they walked through the door. At one point, Tommy wanted to have Scott Holmes, who'd been cast as Mike, also play Chris R. Scott was supposed to pull this off by wearing what Tommy described as a disguise, a black Indiana Jones-style hat and horn-rimmed glasses, on the assumption that the audience wouldn't notice. Scott was no pushover physically, but in terms of attitude and aura, he was about as menacing as an Ewok. When Don learned of Tommy's trouble finding a good Chris R., he suggested that Tommy meet his stacked 6'3 roommate, Dan, who cut a nicely intimidating figure. Prior to The Room, Dan was busy doing things like competing in the 2002 Olympics on the Armenian bobsledding team, working as a motivational speaker in Los Angeles' Armenian community, and starting successful internet companies. Dan's audition for Tommy was his first audition ever. Not one to phone anything in, he read up on Stanislavski and Uta Hagen beforehand, on the mistaken assumption that Tommy knew something useful about either. On the first day of filming, Dan arrived on set in character and stayed in character. Trained or not, the guy had become a hellfire missile of method. In his tight black tank top and even tighter black beanie, he was at times so frighteningly locked into Chris R. that no one dared talk to him. Between rehearsals, Dan would stalk back and forth along the set's edge, muttering and swearing, keeping himself angry. Dan had some questions about Chris R. We all did. Why the name Chris-R, for instance? What's with that hyphen? Tommy's explanation? He's gangster. What about this drug business, which never comes up either before or after Chris R. is only seen in the film? We have big problem in society with drugs. Chris R. is gangster and Denny takes drugs, so he must be rescued. The original Chris R. scene opens with Denny playing basketball in an alley. Chris R. suddenly joins Denny and demands, "Where's my fucking money?" Apparently, Denny has bought drugs from Chris R., which makes Chris R.'s demand for money a little odd, in that drug dealers pretty much require upfront payment. Eventually, Chris R. pulls a gun on Denny, after which Johnny and Mark rush into the scene to disarm him. Soon enough, Don was being filmed, running into the scene with Tommy to disarm Dan. They did several takes. "A lot of emotion," Tommy kept saying. Jolt, the Hungarian sound guy, was immersed in his sound equipment instruction manual and thus still unable to get the sound to sync. Raphael chimed in to say how strange it was that a guy the size of Chris R., who's holding a gun to someone's head and is presumably prepared to fire it, could be jumped on and disarmed so easily. Tommy told Raphael not to worry, that when they got more emotion into the scene, it would all make sense. Then it was my turn. "Be aggressive," Tommy told me. "Really go to the edge of your moment. This is drama. Show these people what you can do. Very powerful." We rehearsed the scene a few times before Tommy announced he was ready to begin filming me. If anyone found it odd that the first thing the room's mysterious producers wanted to see me do was rush into a scene in which I had no lines, they kept it to themselves. In between shots, Tommy noticed that Don had walked away to get a drink of water. This was a mistake. Brianna had already established that water was an issue guaranteed to make Tommy go berserk. When Don sidled back up to the edge of the stage, Tommy stopped the scene that was underway and pointed at him. "You stay here while we shoot, okay? You do not leave set, I tell you right now. Follow instruction. Do you understand?" At first, Don laughed, unable to believe that stepping away from a scene he'd already shot to get a cup of water could possibly be an issue. When Don realized Tommy was serious, his face bunched up. "What's your problem, Tommy? I just stepped out to get water." "No," Tommy said, "you stay here. Your leaving is fucking up our set." Suddenly, I realized that Tommy was creating a pretext to fire Don. The alley scene finally wrapped. Sadly, none of its particular magic ever made it into the film. Tommy had the entire Chris R. scene reshot on another set a week later. The dreadfully unconvincing indoor alley set turns up in the finished film only once, during a scene in which Mike tells Johnny a long story involving wayward underwear. I'm not sure when word got out on set that film hadn't been rolling on Don, but it did, and now several people were whispering about it. As everyone regrouped to shoot the next scene, I became increasingly worried about what would happen when Don found out. Tommy, sensing my discomfort, took me aside and said, "Don't worry about him. If he attacks you, I will protect you." Very reassuring. Tommy chose to shoot next on the rooftop set. Now, the logical thing to do would have been to shoot another of the several planned alley scenes because everything was already set up there, and the rooftop wasn't even completed. But Tommy went with his gut, his weird, inscrutable, unpredictable gut. And so the relevant crew members hurry to put their finishing touches on what has become the room's most famously incompetent cinematic element, deserving of its capital R. To begin, the rooftop wasn't a rooftop, but rather three separate styrofoam walls backed with cheap plywood, all of which had been hastily set up in the Burns and Sawyer parking lot. When shooting rooftop scenes from alternate angles, the crew moved the three walls to create the illusion of four. Unfortunately, they often fail to align these pieces, as you can see in the finished film. Tommy had also determined that a convincing approximation of a fancy San Francisco condominium's rooftop access point would be a sheet metal shed. When this shed was included in rooftop shots, the two styrofoam walls were pulled apart and the shed was pushed into the gap. Movie magic at its finest. Behind the rooftop was Tommy's coup de grâce, a green screen wall. Tommy had decided to add the San Francisco skyline to every rooftop scene via post-production digital trickery. As everyone who's seen the film now knows, this compositing process was not successful. Half the time, the Mediterranean San Francisco skyline more closely resembles that of Istanbul. At other times, it looks as though the rooftop is carrying its inhabitants through space and time itself. The rooftop scene Tommy now wanted to shoot involved two characters: Peter, Johnny's psychiatrist friend, and Mark. Marcus headed up to the rooftop to evade his problems and smoke a joint when Peter arrives to confront him about his affair with Lisa, Johnny's future wife. Mark responds to Peter's accusation with an uncharacteristically abrupt burst of anger and tries to throw Peter off the roof. Then Mark immediately apologizes to Peter for trying to kill him, and Peter lets it slide. It's probably the most swiftly forgiven attempted murder in the history of film. Safua scrambled to throw together our costumes, presenting me with an all-denim getup complete with cowboy boots that made me look like a rejected concept drawing of the Marlboro Man. By now, I noticed that Don was watching Tommy closely. Tommy still hadn't requested new wardrobe for him for the rooftop scene, which must have seemed suspicious. When the camera started rolling, Tommy kept interrupting the scene. As per the original script, Tommy wanted Mark to knock Peter out and then wake him up by dumping a bucket of water on him. Kyle Vogt, who was playing Peter, sensibly pointed out that he had only one suit. "Yeah," Sandy said, unable to believe Tommy was seriously proposing this. "Once Kyle's suit is wet, we can't shoot again until it's dry." Tommy ran his hands through his hair, as though whether or not to dump a pail of water over Peter's head was the most agonizing decision imaginable. We tried the scene again, but Tommy remained unhappy. "There's no chemistry! Voice need to go up, okay? Come on, Greg!" I've never been so aware of someone's eyes on me as I was of Don's at that moment. This was obviously way beyond anything some producer wanted to see. Tommy was also mad because he thought I changed a line in the script. In the scene, Mark is supposed to ask Peter, "Why do you want to know my secret?" Tommy thought the line was, "Do you have some secrets?" But it wasn't. That's something Johnny says to Mark earlier in the film. Tommy didn't know his own script. By this point, Tommy was getting looks from just about everyone, especially Don. To deflect his embarrassment, Tommy yelled, "More emotion!" and kicked a pail of water that turned over and splashed up near his $250,000 worth of cameras. Sandy put his arms on Tommy's shoulders and guided him away, saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, we can't have any of that near the cameras." Tommy was not hearing this. "It's boring," he said. "No emotion." Then he called me over to where he and Sandy were standing, put his arm on my shoulder, and said quietly, "I know what you want to do." I had no idea what he was talking about. "Just do it," he said. "Don't be scared. Throw the stupid chair like your spy movie." It occurred to me that Tommy was referring to Spy Game, which I'd watched that morning. In particular, he was referencing the scene in which Brad Pitt, while arguing with Robert Redford, throws a chair off a roof. Tommy, it turned out, had watched a good chunk of Spy Game from the stairs behind me. No wonder he was so late. "If you want to break chair or something," Tommy said, "break chair, I don't care." In my next take, I kicked over a prop table and threw an authentically frustrated fuck, all to appease Tommy and bring this painful, awkward scene to an end, not only for me, but also for Don. When Tommy watched the playback, he decided that my ad-libbed fuck was his favorite take. He couldn't stop talking about how much he liked that take. It was now evident to anyone paying attention that I was being filmed for something more than a screen test. I looked over at Don and saw him talking with Brianna and Juliet. Brianna was animatedly throwing her hands around. Don was shaking his head. Juliet's hands were clasped over her mouth. Tommy's scheme was over. Dawn knew. 4. Tommy's planet. He has so many realities, and he believes them all. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. David and Donna were scene partners in Gene Shelton's class, and also extremely nice people. But they were in growing danger of raising Samuel Beckett from the dead and compelling him to stomp through San Francisco like Godzilla. I was sitting 2 rows back from Shelton, who was pinching the bridge of her nose and looking into her lap. When David and Donna came to the end of their scene from Waiting for Godot, Shelton was silent, as was everyone else. David and Donna stood on the stage like prey animals, waiting to see which one of them would be eaten first. Gene Shelton looked a little bit like Yoda's mother. Short, glasses, frizzy white hair. Yet she seemed to us, her students, more like Darth Vader. When you got up on stage in front of her, you were pulled between feelings of terror and exhilaration. She was the best kind of teacher, in that you didn't care if she liked you personally. You just wanted her to respect you professionally. Shelton's class was held in a basement studio space on Sutter Street, off San Francisco's Union Square. But for the stage, the room was kept very dark, though you could always see Shelton, thanks to the way the light illuminated her halo of white hair. When you were awaiting her judgment, as David and Donna were now, you dreaded the first few words from her mouth. Her accent was very mid-Atlantic, soft, round consonants and fierce vowels. That big, commanding voice of hers filled the room, cutting through the darkness. "Awful," Shelton said to David and Donna. "That was just... I tell you to try it again, but I doubt you'll do any better." She waited for David or Donna to speak. They didn't. They couldn't even look at each other. Poor selection of material as well. I saw nothing good, nothing useful. She paused. "I'm sorry." That was another thing about Shelton. You never felt as though she enjoyed being negative. She always seemed to genuinely want you to be great. As David and Donna climbed from the stage and collapsed into front row seats, Shelton looked around. "Does anyone want to do anything? We still have some time. The stage is open." The seats in the theater were old, so their creaking served as a good indicator as to how restless the class was feeling. On this evening, the chairs were creaking like crazy. Everyone was ready to leave. To my, and I'm sure everyone else's, astonishment, someone stood in the back row. It was the pirate from the previous week. Today he was wearing black pants, an ostentatiously studded belt, and a gleamingly pearlescent button-down shirt. He had a slightly hunchback posture, and when he walked, his arms barely moved. He was also taking his sweet time getting to the stage. He went backstage and slowly picked around before returning with a fold-out chair, which he snapped open and slammed down on stage so that its back was facing the audience. He straddled the chair, legs spread wide, and pushed his long, dark hair from his face. It suddenly seemed possible this guy was actually sort of great. No one who wasn't great could afford to conduct himself like this. Shelton asked him, "And what are you doing for us, Thomas?" "No, not Thomas. It's Tommy." Bored already, Shelton scratched her nose. "What are you doing for us, Tommy?" "The Shakespeare, Sonnet 116. I heard someone mutter, "Oh no, not this again." I was watching Shelton very closely now. We all were. "Proceed," she said. "Let me not to the marriage of true minds," he began. "Admit impediments." He bludgeoned his way through the rest, each line a mortal enemy. Where the sonnet demanded clear speech, he mumbled. When it asked for music, he went sing-song. Everything he said was obviously the product of diligent mismemorization, totally divorced from the emotion the words were trying to communicate. He was terrible, reckless, and mesmerizing. Once again we waited, frozen within a dreadful glacier of Sheltonian silence. "What is it exactly," Shelton finally said, "that you're trying to do here?" The guy drew his head back and flipped his hair over his shoulder. "Sonnet," he said. "Yes," she said, "but what are you trying to do?" His bearing tensed up. "Send the message," he said. "Express emotion of Shakespeare." That accent, I thought, it sounded almost French, but not quite. Was there some Austrian buried in it? "It's a sonnet," he continued. "You know, sonnet." "Oh, God," someone said next to me, her hand clamped over her mouth. "Yes," Shelton said, which he followed with a quick, huffy laugh. "I know what a sonnet is. What I don't know is what you're trying to do." The guy was silent. His face was getting red rapidly. Shelton noticed this and went into salvage mode. "Look," she said, "the chair is not helping you. It's distracting. Maybe you should do it standing up." His face was now a tomato with orifices, but he didn't budge. "I disagree with that," he said, now barely keeping control of himself. Everyone in that class was at least a little afraid of Shelton. No one ever got mad at her for expressing her opinion, certainly. But this guy wasn't afraid of her. It felt oddly liberating to watch someone confront her. "I see, then." Shelton lifted herself from her chair and turned to the rest of us. "You're all free to go." What I had just seen almost never happened in acting classes. The pirate was not only confrontational, but fearless, a trait I wanted better acquaintance with. Of anyone in our class, this guy had the least cause to be so outspoken, so confident, yet he was. I was intrigued. My mother, who was meeting me for dinner that evening, was waiting outside the studio. Just as I was describing to her the interesting French guy I'd seen in class, the sonneteer himself passed by us. "There he is," I said. My mother enthusiastically marched over to him to say hi, just as any French person outside of France does when informed that a fellow native is within 2 kilometers. "Excusez-moi? Mon fils me dit que vous êtes français, c'est vrai?" The guy whirled around as though he'd been pickpocketed. "No, merci," he said quietly. My mother didn't give up. "D'où venez-vous?" she asked pleasantly. "I have to go," the guy said with a sick, half-secretive smile. My mother and I watched as he slithered away into the night. "I thought he was French," I told her. "That guy is not French," she said. "Whatever he is, I think he's been put through the ringer." Something big was how my agent described it to me. And the more I learned, the bigger it sounded. A film called Wildflowers, starring Daryl Hannah, Eric Roberts, and Clea DuVall, was going to be shooting in the Bay Area. I saw this as my chance to land something that would pluck me out of obscurity and plant me in Hollywood. I ended up getting called back several times. Then my agent called. "Everything was right," she said, "but someone else fit the part better." When she saw how upset I was, my mother said, in so many words, "I told you so." When the person you're closest to is telling you to quit, it's not easy to go on. Her voice was still in my head. An acting career, a pipe dream. Agents, evil with a Rolodex. I was feeling defeated and almost didn't bother going to acting class that night. Any momentum I thought I'd gathered had vanished. Classes, it was becoming obvious, didn't guarantee anything. The only thing that made me consider going to class that night was the prospect of watching the unpredictable pirate go bananas on stage again. During the previous week's class, in the middle of his scene, he had grabbed a glass full of water from a prop table and thrown it against the wall. Then he kept going with the scene as though nothing had happened. When Sheldon asked why he had done this, he answered, "I was in zone." In fact, whenever Sheldon questioned his creative choices, he answered as though he had as much right to expound on craft as she did. That night would be the pirate's final performance with his current scene partner. They decided to do a scene from A Streetcar Named Desire. I had no doubt which scene they'd chosen. Cut to pirate guy in a white tank top, his wild hair in a ponytail, wandering around stage left, crying out, "Stella!" many more times than the script called for, and occasionally breaking into exaggerated sobs. He wasn't even bothering to direct his agony toward his partner, the intended focus of the scene. He was just launching his performance out into space. Two girls in the first row were squeezing each other's hands in an effort to contain their laughter. The actor sitting next to me, an older guy who was normally subdued to a fault, actually began laughing so hard he had to bunch up his sweater around his mouth. The pirate scene partner valiantly tried to bring him around with the smelling salts of actual lines from the script, but he kept yelling over her, "Stella! Stella!" until he went to his knees, covered his face with his hands, cried for a moment, and finished with a final and piercingly wrong, "Stella!" Most bad performances are met with silence. This was something else. There were murmurs. There were giggles. Everyone in that basement studio knew they had just witnessed one of the most beautifully, chaotically wrong performances they would ever see. As for me, I felt resuscitated. I'd never been so happy to be in a classroom. Jean Shelton did not wait to address the lunatic who lay prostrate before her. "Thomas, or Tommy, I'm sorry, I must ask you again, what are you trying to accomplish?" He was rising from the floor now. His face was flushed, his eyes intense little blurs of exhaustion. "I am performing the Tennessee Williams scene," he said. At this, his scene partner, an older woman, shook her head hopelessly. "No, Tommy," Sheldon said, "I don't think that's what you were doing." I sensed Sheldon's brain trying to plan its attack in a distractingly target-rich environment. "First, you did nothing to demonstrate Stanley's objective in the scene." She stopped, shifted, reversed. "What is Stanley's objective in this scene?"
"Stanley is hysterical," he said.
"No, that's not an objective. Stanley loves Stella. He's trying to reach Stella. And if he's trying to reach Stella, to speak to her, he is not going to shout at the stagehands or audience members. He's going to address her. But you hardly notice Stella. As far as your performance was concerned, she wasn't even on the same stage." That's when I realized what he'd been doing up there. He was looking for the camera. He wasn't thinking about Stanley. He was thinking about Brando. For him, there was no stage. There was only an appeal to a camera that didn't exist.
"You're wrong," he said to Shelton.
I don't think she heard him because she kept going. "Also, Stanley is a very strong man, a strong character, and a strong man. He's pursuing Stella. He's not screaming because he's in pain. Stella's right in front of you, and you're yelling in the opposite direction. And so I ask again, what are you doing?"
"I'm sorry," the pirate said. "May I correct you?"
"No," Shelton cried out, pointing at him. "No, you may not." No one was laughing now. But I had a thought. A thought I can't fully explain even today. He should be my next scene partner. I have to do a scene with this guy. Maybe he'd cheer me up. Maybe I'd learn some of his fearlessness. What made him so confident? I was desperately curious to discover that. It wasn't his acting, obviously, which was extraordinarily bad. He was simply